This is the Saturday Night Live Friday Night Speaker Meeting, held at Episode Shopping Center, Room 120 in San Jose, California, on October 9th, 1992. Tonight's 10-minute speaker is Tim D, and the main speaker is David B. The original recording and its copy are at the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. And please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Tim and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tim.
Ron called me about 6 o'clock and just to confirm that I was going to show up. He said, "Are you nervous about doing this?" I said, "Nah, not nervous." I lied. I got sober originally in 1987, January. Didn't stay sober long, about 6 months. I think I had designs on going out pretty much from the get-go. There was a thing that my sponsor told me to do. He asked me, if something gets bad or something gets uptight or whatever, give me a call. Or if you feel like drinking or whatever, give me a call before you do that. So I knew he was going to take a trip to Mazatlan, and I knew he was gone, so I called him up. Got his answering machine, and he wasn't there. So I took off and I went out and got loaded. Stayed that way for about 3 months. What it was like out there was it started out real good. It got, after a couple years, it got bad. After a couple more years, it got worse. And then I made that first attempt to get sober in January of 87 and stayed here for 6 months and took the first 3 steps, and that was about it. Went out there for, June, July, August, September, 3 months, and experienced things that I never thought that I could experience, and made a decision to try to get sober again. This time I had nobody to help me, no parents to help me, no friends to help me. No family, no nothing, and I was kicked out of my house at 25 years old. I had lived out in the real world for on and off for about since I was 18, and this time my parents decided that it wasn't a good idea that I live under the roof anymore for the things that I have done and I stole from. I did the norm. You hear every single story. I've heard so many stories in here that are worse than mine, and I've heard stories where mine's worse than theirs. Bottom line is, I had to check myself into a. Let me tell you that I come from a middle class family, maybe a little bit upper middle class. Lived in Almaden area, Almaden Country Club. Had all those things, and where I ended up on my second go-around to get sober was downtown San Jose at the place called the Downtown Fellowship, which is a halfway house. And it was quite a place. There was about 16 to 20 guys that lived there. Most of them looked like winos right off the St. James Park bench. And I lived there willingly. I remember the day I got there. I had like $250 cash in my pocket, and in order to live there, you had to pay to live there. This wasn't free. You actually had to pay to live in this place, $365 a month. And I remember walking in there and being happy that I qualified to be there, because I didn't have a roof over my head. I didn't know where I was going to sleep. It looked like the back of my truck, and I qualified to get in there. And the day I showed up, I walked in and said, I'm here. And the guy says, "Well, let me show you your room." So I walk into my room, and it's got carpet like this, except worn out, 4 beds, 4 lockers, little tiny room. And the guy threw me a pillowcase and a bed sheet and said, "Have at it." And I just sat there on the end of this bed, and I was scared, real scared. And I had that $250 in my pocket, and I said, "Well, you know, what are you going to do here, Tim? Are you going to pay the money to stay here, or are you going to just, you know, $250 would, you know, I could do something for a couple days with $250 if I manage my money well." And I decided to stay. I was crying. I went out in my truck to get my gear, which didn't consist of much, and I found a card in my truck, and it was from my stepdad, and he's like my real dad, and he wrote a pretty long, detailed letter in this card, and very emotional, how he loved me, how he wanted the best for me, how he was sorry he had to have this kind of what he called tough love to send me out, you know, sympathize with me, empathize with me, whatever you want to call it. And it just broke me up into a million pieces. I was bawling, crying, and it was tough for a couple days there, and I had talks with my sponsor about how I felt and what I was going through, and he helped me through it a lot, and I was able to make it through that place. I lived there 5 months. I paid my rent every single month. It was something I hadn't been used to. There wasn't very much freedom. There wasn't much of anything. And but yet I stayed there because I knew deep down inside that I don't think I had another chance. You know, I hadn't gone to jail yet. Ron can testify that I did a lot of things to go to jail. Ron came in here and I saw him, and he was pretty good friends with a guy that I used to deal cocaine with. And when I saw Ron, and I guess I was probably about maybe 4 years sober or something, and I saw Ron, I wanted to turn and run the other way because I knew he was new. And, you know, I see a lot of people in here come and go, you know, and if he didn't hang around here, I figured he'd go back to see this guy and say, "Hey, you know what, I know where Tim is." And, you know. And I was about $15,000 into the coke hole with that guy, so I'm glad you stayed, Ron. Wreckage of my past that, as I talked with my sponsor, he didn't see fit that I had to go straighten that one out. I just celebrated 5 years, September 29th. Thanks for clapping. I know a lot of people, I watch people clap out there, and they go, no, I like it. Getting sober and staying sober has, you know, my story out there was, if I got into it, which I don't have the time to do, it was very eventful, and I look back on it, and you know, it was a very eventful time. I don't have time to go into it. My getting sober has been more eventful. At 3 years sober, I didn't know whether I was coming or going. I just chaired a meeting here on Tuesday night, and I talked a little bit about it. At 3 years sober, I didn't know whether I was coming or going. I had done these steps. I had done all these things that people told me to do. I tried to help other people. I just didn't feel comfortable. I still couldn't feel comfortable in my own skin. And I didn't know whether, like I said, I didn't know whether I was coming or going. And I just pretty much had drawn a blank on life. I didn't know how to deal with feelings. I didn't know how, you know, all the emotions of the spectrum. I had no idea how to deal with. It was difficult for me. You know, out there for my first 25 years, I never learned how to deal with the emotions of anger, of fear, of sadness, of being happy, you know, you name it. Whatever those emotions were, I never learned how to deal with those out here. Then I come in here and I get sober, and I'm sober for 3 years, and all of a sudden I realize that I didn't realize anything at that point. I realize it now, 2 years down the road. My opinion, I think that that's why people have a difficulty staying sober is dealing with those emotions of fear, anger, and happiness and sadness and all that stuff. They're very overwhelming. And I found out that to not feel them and to pretend like they're not there and to just say, oh, this too will pass, you need to somehow find out a way to deal with those things and have it be okay. And as a result, I had to check myself into a hospital at 3 years sober because I just hadn't a clue. And I did that. I've been into two hospitals. I've been into recovery house. In my estimation, I have gone to any lengths to stay sober. Those first 3 years were incredibly difficult. I got through those emotional things and how to deal with it. It's a lot better now. I still have trouble at times, but things are a lot better now. I feel like it's okay to be a human being today. I feel like it's okay to be sad. It's okay to be mad. It's okay to be glad. It's okay to be anything I want to be at any particular given time, that because I'm a human being. And that feels good. That's the whole thing that I was looking for when I got here. I wanted to somehow have... Somehow I feel normal, quote unquote, you know. And as a result of going to any lengths and to stick with it and to have faith and to give up but never give up, that's a paradox. One of the paradoxes I find in this program. I mean, you've got to give up, but you can't give up if you understand what I'm saying. I persevered in this program, and as a result of doing that and sticking with it and trying a lot of different things and talking to a lot of different people and not talking to a lot of different people and just experimenting with what works with me and what doesn't work with me and giving myself the A-OK to do that, the last 2 years of my life have been excellent. I've had trials and tribulations, but it's been nothing like it was the first 3 years. And I say these things because if you're new here, or you have 1 year here, or you have 2 years here, or you have 3 years, or whatever, and you're still not feeling right, but you're still sober, just hang in there. Things will change. You just keep experimenting. Keep talking to people. Keep asking for help. Let yourself be a human being. I'm not nervous anymore. Because I get to sit down now. Thanks a lot for letting me share, and if you're new, keep coming back.
Hi, everybody. My name is Dave, and I am an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome the newcomers. You know, if you stay here in this program, you're going to have the surprise of your life. You're going to find something you never could find before, peace and contentment without drinking. That's what this program has to offer, how we live one day at a time and don't have to kill ourselves by drinking to get it. And if you go back outside and start drinking again, you're going to get a big surprise again, because it gets worse. No matter how long you stay in or when you go out, it always gets worse. This thing scares me worse than you do. I'm supposed to share a little bit of what it was like and what happened and what it's like now, and I'm going to try to do that. And I asked my sponsor, I said, how in the world... How do I do this? And he said, you just do two things. He said, you tell the truth and keep it simple. And I said, that's hard for me. But I'm going to try to do that. I was raised in a little town in Holdenville, Oklahoma. I'm an Okie. My mother is a full-blooded Indian. I'm half Indian. Neither one of those things mixed with alcohol. It's a funny thing about the race of Indians and alcohol, but it is true. I've never, ever, ever in my life known an Indian who could drink. I never have. And there may be some available, but I'm not one, and I don't know of any, so they're probably, most of them can't. I'll get calmed down a minute. Just bear with me. I lived with my mother for 10 years. She was a woman and a mother and a drunk. And she got killed walking along the highway with her shoes in her hand one night, and they came and told me that she had died, and I woke up and I don't remember feeling anything. I don't remember feeling pain or anger or anything in the world. I just remember being there. But she used to bring home men, and my grandmother would come over and rescue me from her because she thought that was damnation, and I was not to be in among it, so she would come over and rescue me and take me over to her house. So I went to live with her the last 5 years. Now, I don't know what a witch looks like. I really don't. I have some preconceived notions after seeing a lot of things in my life, but my grandmother was truly a witch. Not only that, but see, she carried this big stick out here, and I was always on the other end of it for some strange reason. And she blew me a star up in the air who wouldn't let you do anything to be human, and I didn't like him either. And I lived that way for 5 years, and then he destroyed me. He made me do a lot of things and feel a lot of things, and I didn't want to feel or think. And she died 15 years old. And they came and told me on the floor that she was 15 up at my aunt's house, and the only thing I remember feeling is relief. And that's the truth. I have to admit that. Later on, as I remember, many, many years ago, when I came into this program and I had to make a fifth step. I went out, I said, how do I make a fifth step? How do I make an amend to my grandmother who's been dead all these years? And my mother who's been dead all these years. And I didn't hate them. You can't hate your mother and your grandmother. You just can't. But you hate what they stand for, and you hate what they do, and you hate what they make you do. So I went out in the woods, and I wrote a big, long letter, and I got out down on my knees, and I said, look, Grandma, I didn't hate you. I just didn't like your God, and I didn't like the way you treated me, and I didn't like the way you made me feel. And I didn't like the house we lived in. I didn't like the way I felt. And she understood because I got better. You see, when I came into this program, I stood, when my grandmother died, and my grandfather had a big hallway upstairs, and I went upstairs and it had a big two-faced closet. Now, it always felt a little bit strange in this family because I had two brothers who were drunks, and my mother was a drunk, and my aunt was a drunk, and my grandfather didn't drink, but I went in the sodas one time, and I came home, and I brought a fifth of booze and set it down on his box and told him he could tot it, and he totted that sucker to death and never did it again. And I didn't know how come he could and we couldn't. But anyway, my grandmother, I was standing down, went up to this hallway, and they had a sliding door in the hallway, and I was standing up at the sliding door, and I opened the sliding door, and there's a bunch of papers in there. And I found out that I was adopted, that they really didn't want me either. And something happened to me, I don't know what. I realized that deep down inside me, I was not capable of being loved, that it was impossible for you to love me. Not because of the way I felt, but because of the way I felt. I knew that my mother didn't love me. She went off and left me at 10, walking along the highway with her shoes in her hand, got killed drunk. I knew my grandmother didn't really love me because she brought her God with me and her big stick, and I knew she didn't care about me either. And I was 16 years old, didn't care about anything in the world, including myself, and guess what happened? You see, the only path that I could handle came to me just as miraculously as anything in the world. I could find somebody gave me some booze. I don't know what happened. I cannot tell you the first drink I had. I do not know when it was or how it felt or nothing else. All I know, I've been chasing it ever since. I know what it did to me. I never took a drink of alcohol in my life except for the feeling I got from it. And it didn't make any difference. I thought that I was, when I picked up a drink, it made me feel better. If it happened, I wouldn't drink the damn stuff. All made me feel better. And it all worked. If I ever drink it again, it will for 3 minutes or 4 minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 minutes or an hour or an hour and a half or 2 hours, and then I'll go on the other side and it won't again. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I got this piece of paper, and it ain't to tell you what to say. It's just chronologically, I don't remember doing nothing. I'm telling you, I left so many blackouts, I couldn't remember nothing if my life depended on it. If I had to remember a year, it would be difficult. It really would. Between and there's another thing, you know, my grandmother, when she died, she carried all this God stuff, and she carried all this religion stuff, and she used to sit on my shoulder. You guys don't think I'm nuts, but she really did. She'd sit on my shoulder, and I'd go in, and I couldn't do anything that I wanted to do that was human to do without having a drink to do it. And then what happened was, when I started thinking I didn't want to do it, and I got ready to do it, and I got ready to do it, I started sitting in the bar and working myself down, and by the time I got the other end, I was too damn drunk to do it. But you see, alcohol was my friend. The greatest friend I ever had. It allowed me to live in a world that I couldn't live and participate in otherwise. I really couldn't have. I would have died, I think, if it had not been for booze. I really do. I hated myself. I hated the world. I hated my grandmother. I hated everything else. And the only reason that I didn't wind up in a lot more places than I did was because of the teachings my grandmother gave me. I give her credit for that. She did instill in me something that saved me from... I went in prison, but I didn't go in for anything that was... I went in really what I went in for. But you see, through all of that, I really, honest to God, I drank from the time I was 16 years old. I remember that when I was a little thing, I woke up one morning in the Holdenville County Jailhouse, and I had one shoe on and one shoe off, and it was colder than hell outside, and I knew I had to walk home. I got up and I walked home, and it never occurred to me that alcohol might be bad for me, that there might be something wrong with my drinking booze. I remember one time I'm getting a little bit ahead, but I got married and I drove into a car, really, I think. What really happened is my car went under this truck, like this. And somehow I got up to the curb and I sat down and the cops come and got me and took me to the hospital, and they got up in the hospital and they called my wife. My wife came up and she saw me in the hospital. I'm raising up and down trying to get a cigarette and the whole book. And then I woke up the next morning and with a big bandage on my face, and I asked her, "How about get this bandage on my face?" Never thought there was anything wrong with my drinking. Took a poor judge one time and he said, "I sentence you to 2 years, 8 months, and 14 days." That's what I served. I sent you to 5 years in the penitentiary because I had stole some money. Never occurred to me that there might be anything wrong with my drinking. I was never, ever, see, I thought of my friends, you got to realize it, made me able to live in a world where I couldn't live in otherwise and do things I couldn't do otherwise and be somebody I couldn't be otherwise. Alcohol was a panacea for me. It was the thing that made me okay. It healed me and made me in other people's eyes okay. So I decided, and I was in the, finally, after I realized that I was adopted, I found my real mother's name. And I decided I'd go see my real mother. And I got this delusion all in my head that once I see her, everything's going to be okay. She's going to be the best mother in the world. She's going to love me. She's not going to be drunk. She's not going to drink. She's going to love me. She's going to take care of me. She's going to do all the things that mothers do for a kid. And I'm going to be happy. So I went to Chautauqua, Kansas, and I walked in my mother's house, and I didn't know at the time that she was full-blooded Indian, but I did quickly as I got there, because she got up and she walked over and put her arms around me and blew her drunken breath in my face and said, "I love you, David." I said, "Oh, no, not again. Please, not again." So I took $50 and left. The only thing I like about the thing to do to me. Then I decided, well, I'll just come to California. I'll come to California and everything will be okay. When I get out here, everything's going to change. Everything's going to be okay. Ain't going to be no more booze. Ain't going to be no more jailhouse. Ain't going to be no red lights. Ain't going to be nothing. Everything's going to be fine. So I got out here in California, and damned if I didn't get married. I figured that I was going to be okay. If I was going to be okay, I needed somebody to be okay with. So I just got married. And boy, did it get okay. I married a redhead. To start, that was my first. I was 34 years old. I still believe that anybody would love me inside. I really and truly believe that deep down in my heart that nobody that I was not worth loving inside. I really did believe that. This lady tried. She really did. She did a spring drink. Now that I think about it, I'm not quite sure where, because she does now, she didn't then, but maybe I'll go to her, but I don't really think so, I don't know. No, but she did the best she could. She could not buy a vote. She knew that when it came to a choice between her and alcohol would win. Believe me, friend, when it came to a choice between alcohol and myself and alcohol, when it came to a choice between alcohol and anything in this world, doubt that. Never, ever doubt that. I'm going to go back to, I'm going to go to the last month of my drinking. I had a long jail out of lad prison, turned out of red light, 502. I got so damn paranoid. I parked my car 2 blocks down the street and walked to the bar so that the cop wouldn't get me. Damsel wouldn't walk back down, get in my car, drive again. I didn't have no brains when I drank. Do any of us have any brains when we drink? I don't think so. I certainly didn't. My wife decided that it was time to leave me, and I always wondered, or I wondered at the time, how she could do that. I paid my bill sometimes. I didn't write hot checks sometimes. I was a good father sometimes. But most of the time, I was a drunk, because that's what drunks do, drink and get drunk. So she decided she would leave. She got the phone. I had 2 little girls by this time, and I know how they got here. I had 2 little girls, and they were waving out of the back seat of the car at me like that, and I'm telling you the truth, my heart was broken because I knew I was not going to see them again. Wait a minute, before I do that, let me back up a little bit. I have a daughter named Christy. Christy is the love of my life. And there's a reason why she's the love of my life, and I probably better tell that before I tell about her driving off. I had this feeling inside that no one could love me, that it was impossible for them to love me and give me the love that I needed and craved. One night, me and her mother and Christy, my other daughter wasn't born yet, were down at Disneyland. We lived at Orange County, in Orange County, and we were down at Disneyland, and my wife had gone inside the Haunted Castle, and I was standing outside with my daughter, and I was standing billing and cooing on her, and billing and cooing on her, and she was billing and cooing at me, and all of a sudden the world stopped. Just stopped. There wasn't anybody there but me. And that girl crawled in my heart, in my head, and for the first time in my life I knew that somebody loved me without reservation. Somebody loved me without wanting something from me, or somebody loved me and could touch me, and I didn't have to be scared of it. For the first time in my life, another power had been able to love me. Scared the hell out of me. I couldn't quit drinking after that. Just got worse. I'd think about that, and I'd go out and I'd just get drunker. I just couldn't handle it. I didn't know how, because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to say it's okay for you to love me, and it's okay for me to love you. When the kid drove off in the car, I knew that it was the last time I was going to see him, and about a week later, I was drinking all the time that I could drink. If I had a dollar, it was to go to booze. If I had money, it was to go to booze. I'd been through San Francisco, Skid Row, the whole bit. Doesn't make any difference. That's what drunks do. That ain't got nothing to do with anything else. Drunks just do things like that. And the kid had been over at the house that day, and it was about a couple of weeks before I quit drinking finally. The kid had been over at the house that day, and all over 4 a.m. when I got up, I'd go out to my car, and I'd walk around my car, and I'd look at my car and make sure there wasn't no dents on it. Make sure there wasn't no dents, and no blood, no people on it, nothing more. Scared the hell out of me. I always knew somebody was going to jump in front of my car, because I tell you the truth, I do not ever remember home and remembering it. I can't believe I did that, but I cannot remember driving home and remembering it. I always got home, never got in trouble, but I never remembered it. Couldn't believe I did that. Still today, don't know how I did that. But anyway, I walked out to my car, and I was getting ready to go to the liquor store, and walked in front of my car, and it was a blue, my car was blue, and the blue fender was gone off my car. I said, now, just a damn minute here. Somebody done hit my car and run. So I went around the carport, and I was looking for my fender, and I couldn't find my fender, looking for blue paint on somebody else's car. There wasn't any blue paint on nobody else's car. I said, damn, what happened to my car? So I got in the car, and I drove down to the liquor store, and for some reason, unbeknown to me to this day, I bought a six-pack of Dr. Pepper. Drove back to my car, and I drove in my driveway, and there was a telephone pole sitting here, and there was a blue piece of metal sitting in the telephone pole. So I got out, and I walked over and picked up my blue fender. Damn, somebody's been driving my car. Then I got home, and I got to shaking. because I realized that it could just as easily have been my daughter that I hit and killed and would not have known it till I sobered up. God, I loved her. And I just couldn't believe that I could do that. Well, I didn't quit drinking. Yet. About 2 years later, I walked in my house and I had had it. My gut was gone. My head was gone. I just had it. I walked in and I laid down, fell flat on the floor with my arms outstretched, beaten. And I looked up and I said, God, please help me. I can't help myself. I don't know how to quit drinking. I can't quit drinking, Lord. I don't know how to stop. And I didn't. And I couldn't. And I didn't know how. I'd like to say that I quit drinking that night, but I didn't. Took a week later. Finally, I came into the San Pablo Fellowship. I don't know whether anybody's ever heard of the San Pablo Fellowship or not. A lot like this one. Remind me of this one. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place where you can come and you can sit down in a chair and get a warm fuzzy from the bottom of your toes to the top of your head and not have anybody say a word to you. You say a word to anybody? That's what happened to me tonight. I came and sat down. I just started getting warm all over. Just knew I was home because the San Pablo Fellowship was like this. We sat around most of the time. We talked about, hey, did you go out and drink today? No, I did not. Hey, man, that's a winner for doing that. They made me feel important because I didn't drink for that day. They didn't care about tomorrow or a week from now or 2 weeks from now. They said, if you didn't drink today, you're in, man. You're it. And I believed it. And it saved my life. You see, in all the time, I have never been beaten in my whole life. I've been hit a lot of times, and I've been in car wrecks. And I've been thrust about a time or two, but I have never been beaten till alcohol beat me to a pulp. It beat me to the point that I just quit fighting anything and everything and quit trying. And I lay on my floor in that room, and I'll always remember that as long as I live. I felt absolutely hopeless, absolutely helpless. I could not move. I could not do anything, and I knew that I was beaten. I knew when I looked up and prayed to a God that I didn't believe in, with hope that I didn't have, and with feelings that I knew were genuine, God help me, because I can't help myself, I knew that I was absolutely beaten. So I surrendered to not drinking. Didn't surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous yet, but I surrendered to not drinking. You see, a bottom ain't a problem. I've been to prison, I've been to places and a bottom. A bottom is when sometimes deep down inside your gut you know that you just have had enough and you can't drink anymore, because if you do, you're going to die inside again and you ain't going to go through that anymore. That's a bottom. Just can't drink anymore. See, if my arm gets cut off, I just go to the doctor and get it sewed back on. If my wife leaves, I just cry a lot. If one of my kids dies, I go to the funeral and cry. But damned if I drink. They told me when I got to San Pablo that I had a mental obsession. I already knew that. They didn't tell me nothing I didn't know. One of the mental obsessions were telling me what. You see, I raised in country music, and you play me a fast song, and I drink yourself beer, and that's really the truth. I mean, that's the way it works. We used to stand out and fix more cars and drink more beer, and you chicks stick there, and that's just the way it works. And when I came in here, I used to play Tammy Wynette, and I would listen to that D-I-V-O-R-C-E, and I would go absolutely out of my ever-loving, berserking mind. And I had this car, and it had this dumb radio in it, and this radio, every time I'd drive down the damn street, this song would come on, and I'd look at it and say, how did you get on? And I knew I turned it on. I mean, I ain't no dump truck, wasn't nobody over me, but I couldn't figure out why I do that to myself. And I didn't know what a willing link was to. I didn't know that I was willing to go to any link. I don't know what that meant. But I put the damn radio out of my car and put my car. And that wasn't because I put the radio out of my car. That's why I didn't want to do it. Now, I wouldn't suggest that everybody do that, but I tell you one thing, if you want to buy the radio, just put the truck on your car and you won't have to listen to it. This person offered me $100. He said that if I ever one day at a time, pick up a drink, and I get my mind absolutely well. I get absolutely perfect in my mind. I got none of them things that drive me to drink in my head. And I pick up a drink. The outer thing will keep me glued there till I die again. That is unpreventable for this drunk. You see, no matter, I've been on this program now a long time. And if I pick up a drink today, as much as I picked up when I first came in, it'll do the exact same thing to me. Guy called me the other night and he said, "I'd like to talk to you," and I said, "Okay," so we talked a little bit. And he wanted to get sober. And I said, "Thank you for calling." He said, "What do you mean, thank me for calling?" I said, "Well, you're talking to me. Number one, you're talking to alcohol. That's the things that I've been doing, and I don't have to go back out and do it again to prove it. Second thing, you're talking about alcohol, the same way I do it, I'm about to come back. God help me if I ever went out again. I know what would happen. I would die someplace in the gutter with a... trying to find a piece of cardboard to put on me, a wine bottle beside me, or whatever. It wouldn't make any difference. You see, I'm faced with an obsession that only leaves three alternatives. I can only either get insane, quit drinking, or die. One of the three, and there are no other alternatives for this drunk. Never, ever any other alternatives. But God, it was good in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I didn't have them red lights coming after me, and there was girls there. And I finally knew what to do with the girls without having my grandmother sitting on my shoulder to get drunk. God, that was a revelation. I'm telling you the truth. Finally, there, that old wolf. Man, I tell you. And I apologized to her a long time after. I really didn't hate her. I just hated what she stood for. I didn't like her God to start with. So, I was in the program 16 months, and I decided that I'd go to a conference. And the conference was in Squaw Valley. Squaw Valley, boots and short skirts. And I figured, well, what I do, I don't want to go to Squaw Valley program. I haven't got enough sobriety. I'm just a little bit worried about getting drunk. So I said, what I do, I'll park on this side of the hill, and then I'll drive over every day to the conference, drive back, and I'll be okay. So I took a week off, and I went up there and found this Sierra Inn. It's the name of it, Sierra Inn. So I walked in this Sierra Inn, and this, it was in October. There wasn't nobody there but me and the cleaning lady and the bartender and the food lady. And, you know, I thought it was all right. I thought it was special arranged to come find out it was, but I didn't know at the time. So I went in and I asked this woman, I said, well, does it get cold up here? She said, yeah, in the wintertime. I said, does it get 20 foot of snow and 20 degree below zero weather? I said, sure enough. She said, yeah. I said, oh, okay. Well, I went to the conference and I stayed 3 days and met a lot of wonderful people and had a wonderful time, as I do at all the conferences I go to. And anyway, I came back and I came to the Sierra Inn. Got out that Sunday afternoon and picked up, had something in the trunk, and I opened the trunk and picked it up and started to go in, and a voice came out of the blue from someplace. Now, please don't think I'm losing my mind. I ain't. Really, truly. A voice came out of the blue and said, find a God of your understanding. And it startled me, and I looked around and I said, well, okay. So I went on in and I sat down, and that afternoon, the Sunday night, I went out and I was walking in. They had a great big field in the back of this thing, and I was walking in this field, and they had tall grass, and I kicked up the grass, and there was a lizard ran across the road. And I looked up and I said, well, you're a pretty smart feller. How would you prepare that lizard to live through 20 foot of snow and 20 degree below zero weather? And I thought and I thought, and I said, I'd dig a hole, and I'd put the lizard in a hole and let him hibernate, and in the summertime he'd come out, and he'd run around, and he'd be okay. And it just said, okay. So the next day I was out walking in the field, and it was a grasshopper got up and flew across the field. And I said, okay, smart ass, how would you prepare a grasshopper to live through 20 foot of snow and 20 degree below zero weather? And I thought, and I thought, and I thought, well, I'll tell you what I'd do. I'd take this leaf, and I'd fold this leaf up, and I'd put this larvae in this leaf. Now, I understand, I ain't very bright, but I got to figure out something, right? I said, I'd put this larvae in this leaf, and I'd fold this leaf over, and then I'd have this leaf. And when the snow come up and melt over the leaf, it would make it warm, and the larvae would be safe in there, and then the snow melt, and it'd come open, and the larvae would come out. Makes sense to me. I said, gee, you're pretty damn smart, ain't you? Yeah. So the next day I'm walking along and I'm sitting down at the base of a tree reading the big book. And I look on my shoulder and there's a butterfly. And I said, what's the butterfly doing? I mean, why didn't it move? Why didn't it run? I didn't say it out loud. I said it in my mind. And the butterfly just sat there. Pretty soon it got up and just gracefully floated away. I said to myself, okay, Smarty, how would you prepare a butterfly to live through 20 foot of snow and 20 degree below zero weather? And I started crying. Because for the first time in my life, I had known that there was something that I couldn't do. That I was powerless to do something. It amazed me and startled me and made me okay. I didn't know that there was anything I couldn't do before. And that sounds strange, but it was true. I found God as I understand God. God, I hope you find him. Anyway, and I'm sure you will and do and have. It's a great experience moving from nothing to something. It's a great experience moving from being half a shell into being something whole. It's a great experience to be from moving to where you think you're nothing to you know you're something. It's a great experience to move from being feeling like the absolute pits of the earth and move into being something that resembles a butterfly. God. What a great experience. I don't know how to exactly tell this. I had to move, change fellowships because, they still don't get involved in your first year, and I was not very bright, and I was not, I mean, I was pretty well, but I wasn't wrapped that tight. And I got involved with this girl, and I knew that she had a real problem. She was a gambler and an alcoholic, and she would call me from the gambling bars and call me to come over there and give her money and to gamble with. And I would go over there and take her home. And I knew that if I stayed in the San Pablo Fellowship, I was going to get drunk. Because she, even to this day, sure, whether they were or not, and that's okay, because it doesn't make any difference. Because all she did was give me power and love and made me feel like made me feel everything was okay. That it was okay for me to move from that fellowship, that it was okay for me to go to another fellowship, that I could stay sober and I didn't have to drink and I was going to be okay. Damn, I loved her. Damn, she was a neat lady. But you know what came out of that? Did you know that in all the time I've been on this earth, I have never had a lady friend? That sounds strange, but I never knew what having a lady friend meant. I knew what ladies were for. I knew what ladies represented, and I knew what ladies, but I never had a lady friend in my whole life. And when I found Popcorn Jenny and I got her as a friend, the whole world opened up. God, I got a lot of lady friends after that. I really did, the whole fellowship. You can't believe it. They'd walk up and hug me and make me feel like a whole human being. You see, it's true that you can't be a friend outside till you're a friend inside to yourself. You can't give love outside till you can give love inside to yourself. You can't really even laugh outside. I mean the kind of belly laugh that comes down from deep inside. You can't really laugh outside till you learn how to laugh inside. One of the first spiritual tools I ever learned in Alcoholics Anonymous was when I saw many people in San Pablo were laughing. And I hadn't laughed in years because drinking was not fun any longer. I was not hilarious by my drinking. I hated my drinking and it was not funny. When I came in they laughed and I realized that they were laughing at themselves. They were not laughing at me. And I couldn't believe it. They matter of fact, some of them told me things and I said, quit laughing. But you see, the ability to laugh within yourself is a powerful force. You're able to see the world in a different way and look at the world a different way if you're able to laugh at it. And then I took my car one night down at you know, I've been in this program for 18 years, and I have been in three fellowships. I've never belonged to a group in my life. I belong to the San Pablo Fellowship, the Elson Brownie Fellowship, and the Concord Fellowship, and darned if I ain't speaking at another fellowship. Me and the fellowship got something in common. I like them. I really do. But anyway, I went down to the fellowship one night, and I had my car parked out front. And somebody stole my license plate. I don't know what the hell they stole them for. I still to this day don't know what they are. I think they probably used them for in a robbery or something. I don't really know. But they took my license plate. Oh, never mind. Back up just a minute. I get ahead of myself, but I'm sorry. But I'll get there. Honest, I will. You can get there from here, I know. So anyway, I hit the telephone pole and knocked my fender off, right? I put the fender back on, bolted it on, and the headlight hanging down like this. The fender was bent over, hanging down like this. And the hollow telephone, I can't fix the fender. How come you can't fix the fender? Because if I fix the fender, I ain't got nothing to show me. I don't know. This highway crew looked at me and said, what's wrong with you? I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I got this fender that's been busted by me while I was drunk. And I want to keep it as a souvenir so that I know that if I go out again, the other guy's going to get the same thing. And he said, just a minute, guy. Well, you got to get the fender fixed. I said, no. He said, you got to get the fender fixed. I said, no. Yep. All right. Well, I go down to fellowship and I tell these guys, hey, I got to have something to do with this fender. This fender, I'm going to get drunk if I don't do something. But I was young and sobriety, and I really felt that way. So my pastor told me, he said, I told him what you do. He said, you get down on your knees and said, you ask God to give you something to show you've been a drunk. I said, huh? He said, get down and say, God, I don't know what you're going to do and what I'm going to do, but said, you give me something to show that I'm a drunk. Sounded weird to me, but I'll do it. So I did it. And the next day, believe it or not, I go up to get my license plate, right? I take guy from AA with me. I go pick up my license plate, and I take them to the bag, and I pull them out and just die laughing. Because the license plate says LZA 502. I say, God has a sense of humor, God. Don't take him too damn seriously. You really got a sense of humor. Be careful what you pray for. You might get it. He's got a sense of humor. I tell you, he really has. One of the great things that this program has given me is friendship. About 14 years ago, I met my wife, and that was a rather strange situation. I think I'll tell it to you. She's not here. I guess I can do it. I was going with a girl named Ruth, and I was in love with her. We were going to get married, but Ruth developed cancer. And she didn't want to get married because she didn't want to be tied to me when she died, and she didn't want that to happen. So I stayed with her until she died. And I got to thinking about all this, and my best thinking got me here. And that don't sum up my best thinking. So I got on my knees again, and I said, look, I realize that everything I put my hand in and pull back out, we both know what it smells like. So I tell you what, if you will just direct me, I'll do the rest of it. He said, okay, I guess. Didn't tell me that, but I think that's what he said. Because I went to a meeting in Concord, and I saw this girl. Dang. That's her. That's the one I'm going to marry. That's the one God gave me. That was 14 years ago. Still believe that today. Honest to God, true story. But for the first 2 years, I wasn't absolutely sure what he gave it to me for. I did not think of the poor, but I thought of money any number of times. You see, here I was, this fellow who had not known how to love, and I came in Alcoholics Anonymous and had found love all over the place, and these girls just hugged me to death because I'm just lovable, I guess. Because I'm not accepting them because they know that I'm in here for sobriety, and that's the truth. And they all knew that, and Ruth was there, and I was attached, and so they all just put their arms around me and hugged me and made me feel good and made me feel whole. And by God, she didn't like that. She was jealous as hell. I couldn't believe it. And I would, you know, there's something that, you know what trust is? Trust is when you can let a person do something that they want to do and let them do it without your having to know about it. See, trust is, it's the hardest thing in the world to bring back once you lose it. Hardest thing in the world to bring back once you lose it. My wife never trusted me with these ladies. Ooh, you'd be surprised some of the things she said. God, I wish we'd all been true. But they were. But she was absolutely jealous out of her mind. So what happened was, she finally decided to go to meetings over in Panola, and I went to meetings in Concord. And we gave each other space. We developed a relationship that's almost beyond my comprehension. I have never known any woman in my life like my wife. And I'm not saying it to brag. I'm just saying it for the truth. She allows me to do whatever it is that I choose to do, and I allowed her the same privilege. I trust her implicitly, and she trusts me. And that comes, listen, that comes through the program with Alcoholics Anonymous. We got married in this program. I have 4 years, and she has 4 years. I mean, you got to be a fan to grow the net, but I don't want to do it. But it worked out because we loved each other, because we were able to look at each other and allow each other to do what was necessary to make the marriage work. And I'm not still today not sure why it happened. She had 4 kids and I had 2. That's an insanity by itself. And now they're our kids. And now we got grandkids. I got a t-shirt. Said the world's greatest grandfather. This is what the world's greatest grandfather looks like. When I was 15 years old, I never believed I'd live to be past 30. Never believed I'd live to be past 30. Never, listen, if you believe you ain't going to live to be past 30, take good care of the merchandise because maybe it's bad. If I'd known I'd only live to this age, I'd take better care of the merchandise, believe me. I've learned and it doesn't happen overnight, and it took me some time to do it, but I've learned how to respond rather than react. Every time I've gotten in trouble in my life, it's been a reaction. I've reacted, and reactions to me are always violent and angry, and they always cause me trouble. And yet, I cannot sometimes keep from responding with a reaction. I cannot do it. It takes time, and this program gives you the time to do it. But it's hard, really is hard. I've learned something in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can love without wanting you to love me. One of the hardest things in the world for me to do was to come in and allow you to inside. You see, I knew what I was. And you didn't know. And I was afraid if you did know, you wouldn't like what you saw and you wouldn't like me. It took me some time to allow you to walk inside my guts and look at me and see exactly the way I am and was. And I found that love can overcome and overconquer most things in the world. I found that God's love for me is constant, but my love for Him ain't. No matter what happens to me, no matter where I go, no what I do, there are times when I am the pit. There are times when I am a holy tyrant. There are times when I get so involved in things that I just want to pull my head off the screen. If I loved God constantly, I wouldn't do that. But I don't. So let me tell you something that might hold true for you. There will come a time sometimes when drinking has to be enough in your life. There will come a time when you got no love, you got no hope, and you got nothing else. The world just stepped up and slapped you in the face, and you better have enough of this program in your life to make sure that you know that the last thing in the world, God, that you can do is take a drink. Because let me tell you something. Alcoholics Anonymous is the simplest program I ever saw. You set a drink right there, and you walk back, and you don't go back and pick it up. Don't confuse that with being easy. It's not easy, it's simple. If you get in trouble, you call your sponsor. If you do things that you have to do to maintain your own sobriety, maintain your sobriety by going to meetings, reading a book, do whatever you have to do. That's what I did. But remember that you cannot go back and pick up the drink. Because alcohol really is the same thing today that it did when you came in the program. But if you don't, ask people who come back in and sit down in the program again. it still destroys. It still terrifies. It still moves. It still kills. It still cripples. It still does all the things that it did before. And the only difference between me 18 years ago and me now, besides the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, is I don't drink. Now, because I don't drink, I get love, I get hope, I get help, I get to be trusted because I don't drink. But that's not easier. It's not because I feel more, because I'm still a self-conceited son of a bitch sometimes. Don't be the issue. It's not because my heart has gotten bigger and better. It has not, but it'll never be that big and better. It's because that I do not drink. I've heard programs say not drinking, not enough. When Ruth died, and I drove up in the trailer, and I didn't believe in God, and I drove him up in the truck to the trailer, and I could see, and she died, and she was buried, and I wanted her to come to the door, and I sat out in the door and cried. Not drinking was enough. When my first wife went and worked in the bars, and I was just sobered up, I hadn't been sober 2 or 3 months, and she came and worked in the bar, she had on a short skirt, and I wanted to go in there and kill every son of a bitch in there. When I stood at the door and opened the door and cried, but I wouldn't go in because I knew if I went in, I'd get drunk. Don't kid yourself. Not drinking is enough. But you have to have happiness besides just not drinking. You have to participate. You have to walk up to somebody and hug them and say, "Hey, I love you. I just have a boy." Both scenes. He was a big old angel, great big guy. I mean, big man. He come in and sat down, and nobody could talk. One day, I got tired of sustained awkwardness. I walked over there, and I walked up to him, and I put my arms around him like this and say, "I love you." Man, he jumped back. I thought he was going to hit me for a minute. And every time I did that, I'd walk up to him and say, "Hug him," and say, "I love you." And nobody else would do that. Nobody else would do that. And you know, he's got 16 years sobriety today. Because the thing that we give more than anything in the world is to each other. The thing that we give more than we do any place else, any time, or to anyone is each other. When somebody comes in and sits down, you know the worst thing that could happen to anybody? If when you go outside and your gut is absolutely dying inside and you're it's just pulling apart and you're ready to kill somebody and kill yourself, and you walk in and somebody says, "How are you?" The person of Alcoholics Anonymous is designed for you to come in and sit down and pick somebody up and say, "My ass, but I put that ass on me, please." Don't kid yourself. Love is helping. Love is sharing. Love is doing. Love is acting. Love in this program is acting. It's doing something for somebody. It's realizing that you're not the center of the universe anymore, that you're just one of the group. You know, one of them. I got a granddaughter back in New Jersey. And she came in up to me the other day, and she jumped in my arms, and she put her arms around me, and she said, "Grandpa!" I said, "What?" She said, "I'm in some deep doo-doo." And I thought for a minute, and I started crying. I said, "Honey, you know, I've been in some deep doo doo myself." Oh, this program is a joy. It's the greatest thing that ever happened in my life. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. I wouldn't trade you people for anything in the world. No place else in the world I could go that I can have hope and love and cherish and feel good. No place in the world I can go and sit down and talk about crawling out from under a piece of cardboard and sobering up and thinking about coming down here. It just amazes me that the things that this program gives is so big and great, and the things we get back to it sometimes are so small, and yet they work. You know, we can't do big things in Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes, but it's little things. When I first came in, they told me that I had to wash cups, and I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. I was a cup washer. Hell, outside, I was a drinker. I was a cup washer. They told me I had to take up the chair. I was a chair taker-upper. I was used to be a drunk. See, no matter what you do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you get paid for it. You get paid for it. If you pick up a chair, you get paid a minute of sobriety. If you walk up and talk to somebody for 10 minutes, you get paid 10 minutes of sobriety. Sobriety is not drinking. Sobriety is learning how to live. Sobriety is realizing that within yourself you're worth living and loving and caring for. Biggest amend I ever had to make was to myself. Hated my grandmother, hated my mother. I had to make them into myself for that feeling, although it wasn't my fault. Although I didn't know that I even felt that way for a long time. I'm going to close, guys. I love you. You've been good to me. You've allowed me to come down and share with you. I hope you find in this program what I've found. Keep coming back. God only knows that it's the greatest thing, the greatest experiment, the greatest thing in your life. Keep coming back.